Guys, we have gifts.
Nice.
More we have gifts. Gifts. Yay.
Yes. So number one, I want to thank the person that sent it. They were from France.
Wow.
One note, anybody who sends stuff, just email into this, into the regular email. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. Ask me for the PO box. I'll send you the PO box, but make sure you make it out to Justin Young, because PO boxes get weird when there's other things, because they think that I'm using it as a business and I shouldn't be using it as a business. I need to pay more to do that, basically. Like if you're running an actual like retail operation out of it. Also of note, so that's the technical note. Here's the stylistic note. This was obviously a well-weathered package because it has traveled oh so far from France to Texas. But please, if you're sending something that far, please keep the political markings on it to a minimum, because while this gift, which you will know, is charming and amazing in 5 seconds, had something delightful inside of it, it was scrawled with "Free Julian Assange" on the front, which made me walk outside to open it to make sure it wasn't anthrax, because you never know. You never know. And certainly you guys did not disappoint.
But think about how many minds were changed within the international postal community seeing that comment about Assange en route.
Exactly. So we have French soaps.
Nice.
And it is said Geneva is for Jen and she gets first soap pick. So I am assuming that also little spoons are here with a some kind of French version of a rubber band that I can barely figure out here. So let's see. What are these spoons? They are tiny little, I guess, teaspoons.
Nice. Tiny silverware.
Yeah. So we have very small silverware. Lucerne.
Looks like I finally own a spoon. Thank you, listener.
And so I guess these are all different cities. It's been instructed that Jen, you get Geneva, Lucerne, and there's two Lucernes and a Geneva. So you get the Geneva. Heaton and I get Lucerne, and you also get first pick of the soaps. So we have a bunch of French words, but two of them are this lemon one, and one of them has a bit more of an Arabic font. So you get to choose. Choose right now which of these two that you would prefer.
I want the big one.
The orange one?
Sure.
Okay, perfect. Then you get that. Heaton and I will fight over the orange or the Arabic one. But thank you very, very much, French listener.
Or we just coordinate our bathing when I'm back in Austin and we become bathing buddies.
I think, they'll just all be at my house. And when Heaton, this will be my coaxing for Heaton to show up on time, is he'll just have to show up 15 minutes before to take his pre-show shower.
Or and I'll show up 5 minutes before and take a 15-minute shower, and be late, which seems far more likely is the kind of thing I would do.
Yeah.
It would be amazing to just see you, just to see what happens when Heaton in full suit has to get undressed and then re-armor up after a 5-minute shower just to use my French soap.
It's a good strategy, though, because if you take a cold shower before we record, then your battle with the air conditioning, I think you might win.
That's what I've been trying. I have a soaking tub in Austin, and I purchased a freestanding freezer shortly before I left. And I find that if I can get the temperature to about 65 degrees and I squat in it for maybe 45 minutes, I'm able to walk around for 20 to 30. So that seems to be right. Yes, the cold shower strategy might be efficacious.
Wait, you bought a freezer to stand in?
No, I bought the freezer to freeze ice in to put in the soaking tub. The water's too hot coming out of the tap. And so if you want to make it 65 during the summer, which begins around, February, then I need to get a freezer in order to have cold enough water.
Gotcha. That does make more sense. Here I am picturing you like a zombie going into your freezer for 45 minutes and then coming out with your teeth chattering.
If I remain in Austin long term, I would probably make a room in my house a meat locker, like in a grocery store or certain liquor stores. And I've thought about it. I'd probably have like a study, but I'd have like a bulletproof glass wall, not to stop bullets, just because I feel like it has to be pretty thick for insulation purposes. And I would just have like a cold room. I keep it like 50 degrees that I'd go into.
I like that. That actually works.
Do you like to be that, like in your relaxation period, like that meat locker cold?
I am most comfortable between 45 and 60 degrees with low humidity. Ew. So like when I go camping, I just go out, it'll usually be 40 to 45 and I'll be in my pajamas and I'll sit outside and drink coffee. And I mean, it can be a little chilly, but like you put on, you know, pants and you're fine. I sleep in about 60 degrees. During the winter, I just leave my windows open.
Wow.
That's remarkable. You're a remarkable man.
Justin and I are different creatures.
I feel like a different species from people much of the time. This is just one of the reasons.
I'm sympathetic to it because I'm like that on the other end, in that like I just know I'm the way that I would like the world to be is incompatible with the rest of the planet. Like they scorn me for my preferences.
Because you are a swamp creature that enjoys humidity.
Yeah. No, I love it.
If a Bond villain came up to me and went, listen, I'm pretty sure I can get the global humidity to like 50% and probably get the average temperature down to around 80 across the globe, but I think a couple billion people might die. I'd be like, well, I think we have to roll those dice, don't we? Don't we have to see if maybe we could make the world a little bit less hot?
From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young. From Edinburgh, Scotland,
I'm Andrew Heaton.
And from Mexico City, Mexico,
I'm Jennifer Briney.
And this is We're Not Wrong. On this edition of the program, we're going to be talking about the new Trump indictment. Do not adjust your podcast players, friends. This is indeed a new episode of the show. A new Trump indictment, this time for January 6th. We're going to talk all about that. We're going to talk about a new study showing that high school boys are trending more conservative, all that, and your emails. I feel like we should get right into our main topic. So we will set this up. I have a feeling we're going to talk.
High school boys?
Yes. We're going to go right into the surging testosterone of high school boys and whether or not they enjoy Steven Crowder videos. No. We will save that for a moment. We will go into the Trump indictment of January 6th. Now, I have a feeling that we are going to spend a lot of time on the indictment itself, so I will let that play out in our discussion. What I do want to highlight are the charges in the 45-page indictment revealed on Tuesday. Trump faces four counts revolving around his push to stay in office in 2020 after losing that election, as well as the riot at the Capitol that happened during the January 6th vote certification. Most conspiracy cases involve allegations that defendants agreed to engage in conduct that violates specific federal criminal law. Two of the charges out of the four that Trump faces does break that mold. One accuses him of a conspiracy to defraud the United States. The other accuses him of conspiracy to violate civil rights. The civil rights charge is brought under a statute that dates to 1870, adopted in the aftermath of the Civil War and sometimes called the first Ku Klux Klan Act. The act was originally aimed at white supremacists and vigilantes seeking to interfere with the ability of Black Americans to vote. In recent decades, the statute has typically been invoked against law enforcement officers accused of violence or mistreatment of people in their custody. The indictment alleges that Trump and others violated the statute in their plot to, quote, injure, oppress, threaten, and intimidate one or more persons in their free exercise and enjoyment of a right and privilege secured to them by the Constitution and laws of the United States. That is the right to vote and to have one's vote counted. The charge alleging a conspiracy to defraud the United States is uncommon, although not unheard of, sometimes called the Klein Conspiracy after a 1957 Supreme Court case blessing the tactic. It is a charge most often seen in tax prosecutions, but is also brought in cases alleging a complex and wide-ranging effort to frustrate the operations of federal agencies. Tuesday's indictment didn't claim that Trump interfered with specific federal agencies. Rather, it accused him of using, quote, dishonesty, fraud, and deceit to impair, obstruct, and defeat the lawful federal government function by which the results of the presidential election are collected, counted, and certified by the federal government, end quote. Former special counsel Robert Mueller wielded this charge against Trump's 2016 campaign advisors, Paul Manafort and Robert Gates, in connection with their efforts to undermine enforcement of tax and foreign agent registration laws. If those charges seem esoteric, Smith also brought two more conventional charges, two counts, including one conspiracy count related to obstructing an official proceeding. In this case, it is the January 6th session in which Congress was legally required to tally and certify electoral votes. Numerous January 6th rioters have already faced and been convicted of that same charge. My question is where this ranks amongst the three that indictments that Trump now faces in likelihood of conviction. And we will start with Jen Briney. I know you have spent a lot of time reading through this indictment and making notes.
I have. If you don't mind, I'd like to go into a little bit more detail of what the indictment actually says, so that we're all on the same page of the details of it. So thank you for going through the four charges. I think it's important to note when we're talking about the charges that he was not charged for inciting a riot or inciting an insurrection, which is what the Democrats had impeached him for within days of the obstruction of the January 6th, 2021 certification of the election. So I think that omission is very important here, because in this indictment, it really is all about the conspiracy that started the day after the election and ended around, well, they actually said it'll end, ended on the day that Biden was inaugurated, but January 6th is not the central part of this indictment. So what the indictment actually says is that while Donald Trump, well, first of all, it's not just Donald Trump. He is the defendant in the indictment, and there are six currently unindicted co-conspirators that are listed as Trump's accomplices, and these are key figures in this entire document. Now, we can figure out quite easily who five out of the six are. They are Rudy Giuliani, John Eastman, Sidney Powell, Jeffrey Clark, and Kenneth Cheesebro. The sixth co-conspirator, neither I nor anyone else seems to be able to figure out who that is for sure, so we're not going to play any guessing games here. But in the 40 plus...
Hell, we aren't.
Well, I mean, I went back into my January 6th committee notes and like, I can't figure it out. So like, I don't even have any guesses
for
you.
Go on. Okay. Well, I'll start randomly yelling names.
Okay. That'll be fun. So in the 40 plus page explanation of Donald Trump's allegedly criminal actions, the indictment says that Donald Trump perpetrated three criminal conspiracies. So first, the indictment alleges that Donald Trump perpetrated a conspiracy to defraud the United States by using dishonesty, fraud, and deceit to impair, obstruct, and defeat the federal government function by which the results of the presidential election are collected, counted, and certified. The indictment says that the manner in which Donald Trump and his co-conspirators perpetrated this conspiracy was by, quote, fraudulent slates of electors in seven targeted states, which are Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, New Mexico, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, attempting to mimic the procedures that the legitimate electors were supposed to follow under the Constitution and other federal and state laws. Now, this included causing the fraudulent electors to meet on the day appointed by the federal law on which the legitimate electors were to gather and cast their votes. They cast fraudulent votes for the defendant and then signed certificates falsely representing that they were legitimate electors. Some fraudulent electors were tricked into participating based on the understanding that their votes would be used only if the defendant succeeded in outcome determinative lawsuits within their state, which the defendant never did. The defendant and co-conspirators then caused these fraudulent electors to transmit their false certificates to the vice president and other government officials to be counted at the certification proceeding on January 6th, unquote. Then as a part of this effort, the indictment also details how Donald Trump and his co-conspirators, quote, attempted to use the power and authority of the Justice Department to conduct sham election crime investigations and to send a letter to the targeted states that falsely claimed that the Justice Department had identified significant concerns that may have impacted the election outcome, that sought to advance the defendant's fraudulent elector plan by using the Justice Department's authority to falsely present the fraudulent electors as valid alternatives to legitimate electors, and that urged on behalf of the Justice Department, the targeted state's legislatures to convene to create the opportunity to choose the fraudulent electors over the legitimate electors, unquote. So that's one of them. The second criminal conspiracy allegedly perpetrated by Donald Trump and his co-conspirators is a conspiracy to corruptly obstruct and impede the January 6th congressional proceeding at which the collected results of the presidential election are counted and certified, which he and his co-conspirators perpetrated by, quote, attempting to enlist the vice president to use his ceremonial role at the January 6th certification proceeding to fraudulently alter the election results, unquote. And I think it's important to know that when the January 6th riot is addressed in this indictment, it is a part of the attempt to pressure Mike Pence to participate in the fake electors conspiracy. And then finally, the third criminal conspiracy allegedly perpetrated by Donald Trump and his friends is a conspiracy against the right to vote and have one's vote be counted. And the indictment says that Donald Trump and his co-conspirators, quote, pushed officials in certain states to ignore the popular vote, disenfranchise millions of voters, dismiss legitimate electors, and ultimately cause the ascertainment of and voting by illegitimate electors in favor of the defendant, unquote. Now, there's about 40 pages of evidence here from many witnesses, and there's documents that explain these conspiracies in detail. And, you know, unlike other Trump indictments where you can kind of look at them piecemeal and get something out of screenshotting individual paragraphs, this indictment is not that. This is one where, yes, it's 40 pages, but I think it needs to be read in full in order to be fully understood. And so I'm curious, did you guys read the entire indictment? And do you think that Trump and his friends deserve to be legally punished for their actions?
I read the indictment. I think Trump does. I don't know about his friends because I don't know to what extent you can make them all culpable of pushing action versus floating legal theory. If John Eastman were to throw out the harebrained, get Mike Pence to claim there's dueling electors, therefore we're going to discount Wisconsin, let's move on. If that's a theory the guy put out, I wouldn't penalize him for coming up with a theory. And I think that is very dangerous in terms of First Amendment. That to me is different though than Donald Trump, who I think you can. I think of the four counts here, the count to commit conspiracy to defraud the United States government is I'm convinced of that, and conspiracy to obstruct official proceeding. I think that those are both pretty clear things that have happened, and I think that the First Amendment grounds, which is probably how this is going to be pushed by the defense for Donald Trump. I think it's possible that he's going to bring up Nixon v. Fitzgerald, which has absolute immunity for the president during the act of his duties. But I don't think it would hold. At least I wouldn't read on it. I think they're probably going to go with, look, Trump really thought this was a this really was fraudulent, and therefore, as president, he was trying to investigate the frauds and push the federal government towards that, which would be fine if that had been what had occurred. If he'd truly thought the election was fraudulent and he'd kept saying, no, Justice Department, I want you to check on this, that would be within his remit as president. However, that's not what he did. What he did was that and attempt to excise votes from this process because he didn't believe that they were good, or alternately, he was cynical. My read is, personally, and I have no way of knowing this, I think either Trump is incapable of processing a reality in which he lost, or he lost and he didn't care and tried to circumnavigate the democratic process. I personally think he cannot comprehend reality in which he lost, and therefore really does think he won the election and acted accordingly. But insofar as he's done that, I think it's fairly obvious that he has circumnavigated the willful election results and thereby has committed fraud against the U.S. government and obstructed official proceedings. It's kind of a clumsy analogy, but for anybody that wants to come up with one, what I've kind of come up with is imagine that your grandfather was going to leave you his house, and then he marries some lady and she convinces him to give the all of his estate to her when he dies. And you're convinced that he was senile. And the executor says, nope, there's no evidence to that. I'm giving the house to her. So you forge a document to try to throw this into disrepute. And then you try to convince the judge to go to the wrong courthouse because you think it'll be a better judge. That's what we're dealing with here. Even if he thought that it was an accurate, or even if he thought it was a fraudulent election, the steps that he took were, I'm going to break the law and circumnavigate the legal process in order to get to the outcome I want, because I think that it was wrong. That I think you can hold up in court, and I think you will be. The other counts I'm more shaky on. So like conspiracy against rights strikes me as kind of a weak one. That's the 1897 Civil Rights Act that that Justin brought up. That one to me is a lot more wishy. The idea that because you are interfering with an election, you have deprived people of votes, that doesn't have a limiting principle to it. So like, whereas I routinely rail against first past the post and gerrymandering, these are things that are near and dear to my heart that I'm very much in favor of rectifying through electoral reform. I don't think you could make a criminal court case against a legislature for committing gerrymandering and then send them to jail for it. I think that would be well beyond the remit of the court system. It seems to me that that logic would apply to gerrymandering or anything else that deprives people of votes in some capacity. So that one, I don't think is going to stick, or at least on first reading, it doesn't stick to me. The fourth one, or no, that is it. Conspiracy against rights. But the other two, conspiracy to defraud U.S. government, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, I think those are met, and I think he should be punished for it, and he probably will be.
I'm not convinced. I mean, it's
surprise,
the same.
Surprise.
I mean, look, I've said this from the very beginning, right? That if part of this is determinative and this indictment spends a lot of time and energy listing off people that told Donald Trump that this was a lost cause, that he had lost, that there was not the fraud that he was saying as proof that he was acting with the knowledge that he was not the victim of a larger conspiracy. It ignores the fact that, and so he stopped listening to them and he started listening to the Apple Dumpling Gang that decided that this was a way to push it. I am not a lawyer. So I will defer to the great legal minds that are listening to this right now as to whether or not there was a clear law that was violated here. But the things that stuck out to me are, it was this official proceeding on January 6th, ceremonial or not? Because if it was ceremonial, and therefore any actions that they took with these fake electors would not have mattered anyway, because Mike Pence didn't have the power, as he didn't believe, and as the indictment itself says that he didn't have, then where is the harm in them doing this, these actions? Now, let me say before, and everyone's got their fucking hands up, let me just say this. Do I find what Donald Trump did abhorrent? Do I find it morally terrible? Do I find it possibly evil that he kicked our democracy hard enough to see whether or not it would break? Yes, I do. The question that has always come up with this January 6th stuff, for which he has been impeached, we have seen 99% of this evidence put out into the public record through the January 6th investigation that took promptly 4 years. Is he legally culpable for it? That's a question for which I don't have the answer. And I would say if it comes down to free speech grounds, it is extraordinarily hard to prove. And with all that said, if it goes to a DC judge and a DC jury, I think he will be convicted.
So I just reading the memos, which were not in the indictment. I did this as part of my January 6th committee episode, but reading the memos that were put out, which stupidly really tell you what their plan was. Even though Mike Pence didn't have the authority to do what they were asking him to do, the goal was not to actually have Mike Pence overturn the election. It was to cause enough confusion with the electors in those seven states to have them set aside. And then if this did go to the courts, what would have happened is it would have been pushed into the House of Representatives to pick the president. And it would be done by state. And if you looked at the makeup of the House of Representatives at that time, there was one more state that was Republican than Democrat, and that was what they saw as their path towards keeping Donald Trump as the president. So I've been on Twitter today. I've seen a lot of people being like, well, it didn't work, so who fucking cares? But the thing is, it could have. And if there weren't people like Rusty Bowers of Arizona who said, no, I'm not participating in this, if we didn't have people in the Justice Department say, we're going to resign if you replace the attorney general with this quack, Jeffrey Clark, who's one of the co-conspirators, who was willing to put out that letter that said there was fraud, that there wasn't. Like, there was a lot of people that stood in the way of this, a lot of people within the Republican Party. And without them, there was a path for this to work. And
sure.
And I don't think the result is the point here. And I believe that with the lawsuit itself, even if this doesn't work, even if he doesn't spend a single day in prison, this man should not be president again. And I think getting these details out in the American public, because he's never going to admit guilt. So we're going to have a trial. It's going to be a fucking circus.
So we're getting him out again. So is this enough time that we can get the details out, or should we schedule another 6 or 7 times to get the details out?
I don't think the details have been out in the way they are in this document. I think this is going to help. I think every time. So
this is good. We are satisfied with this amount of details being out about January 6th and everything that went on.
I think this indictment, the way that it's written, again, you can't do screenshots with this one. You have to read all 45 pages. But if you do that,
read
you
the
will
book,
understand.
Like Game of Thrones.
Shut the fuck up, Justin. I think you will understand if you read these 45 pages what exactly went down in a way that you didn't understand from the coverage of the January 6th committee, because it was so focused on the riot. And that's another thing, to say he was been impeached for this. He hasn't. He was impeached for inciting a riot, which he did not do. He was not impeached for the fake elector scheme. That was not a part of that impeachment, because it happened. That impeachment was like 2 weeks after January 6th. And all of the evidence they had was like, look at all the screaming people. He has not been impeached for this. And so this is different. I think it's important the information gets out. And even if he's not convicted, the fact that the trial will be before the election, I think, is very important for our country.
I don't think that this is going to have an effect on the election that will hurt Trump. We can get to the election in a minute, but I do want to counter some of Justin's points before we move on from the judicial side of this. First of all, great point, Jen. He was impeached over the insurrection, which was not brought up in this court case. Neither the 2382 incite, engage, resist rebellion. That is not in the court case. Neither is section 2384 conspiracy to overthrow the U.S. government. Neither of those are in there. That's what the impeachment of the House was about. To the First Amendment point you bring up, Justin, which I think is the strongest, and I do not want to, like, we have to be very careful. Anytime a major candidate is getting prosecuted, we're already in sticky, dangerous territory, because the last thing we want to do is have politics in our country determined by who's in power and they throw somebody in jail. That is always a sticky situation. We need to tread very carefully, and also thinking about the long-term consequences of whatever precedent are set. So we don't want to do a thing where if you contest an election, you go to...
I am not hearing Eaton.
I'm hearing him.
Let me drop out and come back.
You're on a roll.
Thank you. You're knocking out of the park too. That was a really, really good description. And I'm glad you brought up the whole Eastman conspiracy. And because I don't think people quite understand that. I think it was actually very clever, because what they were basically doing was saying, like, look, throw these seven states into disarray to the point where it goes to the House, which will elect them. Yeah, that was, it wasn't, it was actually a really good idea. And I think if Pence had done it, it would have worked. we're actually, let me rephrase this. I think if Pence had done it, we would have had a massive, massive national crisis that might very well have included a military coup. So I don't know what would have happened, but I think it would have been, I think it would have been an absolute shit show if he'd gone along with it.
Yeah. Did you catch that quote about that's what the Insurrection Act is for? That one I found stunning.
Yeah. Justin, I think your point about the First Amendment is the best one. That is going to be brought up. And the idea that you shouldn't penalize somebody for having an opinion about the election or about expressing their opinion about the election or their legal theories. All of that is true. People should not be penalized for legal theories. I don't think anybody's at this point claiming that Trump should be prosecuted for loudly and incorrectly trumpeting the idea that the election was fraudulent. I think you could have made that case during the impeachment proceedings where he actually was on trial for incitement and rebellion. And you could make the argument that he basically facilitated that, but that's not what anybody's making at this point. The argument that he's just expressing his opinion, I think stops short because this is what circumnavigating the law looks like. Like if you were going to like overturn an election from the certified legitimate process, you'd either have a military coup or you'd do something like this. You'd either do a thing with a bunch of tanks or you would have a bunch of people come in and very questionably lawyer their way around the outcome of the election in such a way that like if Obama had done this back in 2016 to try to keep Trump from coming into office, the Republicans rightly would have said that that was circumnavigating the will of the people and so on and so forth. I think he is culpable for that.
Well, I guess my only question, and let me say that my skepticism here is totally rooted in the idea that I am, while we can all loudly say, yes, Trump is the line. Whatever Trump did here, that's the line that we are uncomfortable with, that we just need to know that we are setting precedent for how far people can go in challenging an election, whether or not we agree with it, and whether or not the precedent that will be set here will be weaponized going forward, because this will be the legal prosecutable line for the status going forward, that it's not just the fact that yes, it could have gone, it could have been worse, but our system held and we should punish him in the court of the world of politics. We should make sure that he is no longer president by way of persuasion, but no, this is now going to be the precedent for which we will prosecute people, whether or not we appreciate them, we like them, or we think that their cause is noble and righteous. And that's something for which it's not to say that I'm disagreeing with this, because again, I found what happened to be odious.
We're just talking about the legal proceedings, not the shitbaggery.
I'm talking about the legal culpability here, and it gives me the creeps, and it gives me the creeps how much everybody is jumping up and down and saying that this is an absolute slam dunk. Like Jen, if you're talking about this as an info war, that yes, it's good that this information is out about this thing closer to the election, then sure, I can agree with that. But that's a political argument. That's arguing against whether or not he should be elected president, and whether or not we're getting him to the amount of electoral college votes in 2024.
So that's just one aspect of this. When it comes to the law, I actually do think this is a very strong case. I mean, keeping in mind that the January 6th committee report was hundreds of pages and this was just 45. So there is plenty more that Jack Smith had that he didn't put in this summary document. But I think where this plan jumped the shark and isn't just a matter of challenging the election is when they tricked dozens of people in seven states to create fake documents saying that the dude won and then turn them in. Like that is a level of fraud that I think is a line that is far beyond anything that should give us the creeps. I don't think that's something that's been repeated or that's happened or is going to happen again.
That's not what I said. I didn't say that gave me the creeps.
I know you didn't say that, but I'm saying that like, if we're worried about this setting a precedent, I don't think that this plan is something. I mean, that's what was so brilliant about the plan. Andrew and I were just talking off air about how the plan was. It was interesting the way they took the Electoral Count Act and exploited the loopholes in it to have a far-fetched and probably not going to succeed plan, but it did exploit some existing loopholes that have since been fixed, actually. So in a way, this actually helped our country secure our election a little bit. But by looking for those loopholes, this whole conspiracy, like those fake documents are key to it. The lying to the people and saying, like, sit here, put your name on these documents. We're only going to use them in this instance, when they knew damn well that they were going to turn them in anyway. Like, that is beyond.
And if it were those people suing Trump and the people that put their names on it and lied to them, then I would be for it. Because it would be them that were saying that they were lied to. This is in punishing people who are challenging an election that I find it's a hard precedent to make.
But what I'm saying is, this isn't a challenge. This isn't a challenge to the election. This was an attempt to change the results. Challenging in court, they had their opportunity. Mm. They did that. And the indictment itself says he has a right to make those challenges. He has a right to lie. He has a right to do all these things. But in trying to get the results to change, that was a bridge too far.
Right. There's a difference between contestation and fraud. The one that Jen brings up, I think, is very valid. So, like, let's go back to 2016. Hillary Clinton and a lot of Democrats, lest we forget, said that it was an illegitimate election that was orchestrated by the Russians. Right. Very damaging. Yes. Things to our society that they should rightly be impugned for at this time. And then Hillary Clinton, which a lot of people forget, quietly went out and tried to get electors to actually elect her president. So there was a moment right after 2016 where Hillary Clinton started courting electors. Remember that the people don't elect the president, the Electoral College does. Yep. And at the end of the day, their votes count, and there's always faithless electors. That's why, like, Frank Byrd and Ron Paul and even some libertarians have been able to get electoral votes in the past. So she started courting them. Had that scheme worked, we could be very angry about it for circumnavigating the process and the will, blah, 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 blah. But it would have been legal. It would have been within the confines of the law. In this instance, it's not. I'm not so much bothered that Trump lied to those people that were serving as the electors for those. That doesn't bother me. What bothers me is that those certifications were provided to the federal government as duly certified electors. So not a situation of like, and they even make a distinction about this in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania did not claim to be duly certified. They claimed to be electors for that exact reason.
Yeah.
The people in Pennsylvania were like, we've not been approved by the governor. We're not certified. We are your electors. And if you're correct, we are then your legally electors, but we've not been certified by it. So they played their cards right. The other ones that were certified to the American government, those were literally acts of fraud. They were saying these are the duly elected, signed by the governor, signed by the state legislature, whatever the mechanisms in their state were, and they were not. Therefore, it was an act of fraud. We can say that Trump thought it was a minor act of fraud in order to save the country from a greater act of fraud. I think you can say that,
yeah.
But it's still an act of fraud. Therefore, it's illegal. Therefore, he is subject to obstructing the federal process and conspiracy to it.
Yeah. And again, past this, I do not have the legal mind nor expertise to make arguments against it. All I can say is if in the analysis that I have read about it, if any of this rests upon, and the indictment does take a lot of effort to explain that Donald Trump knew what the score was, and this was a cynical ploy, and not him unironically believing that he was snowed on this, that if that is determinative in any way, that is one thing for which I do believe he believes to this day that outright fraud kept him from the White House.
That is one part of the indictment, again, though. There are instances where he does indicate that he knows he lost. He indicates that he thought Cindy Powell's, you know, proclamations of fraud were crazy. That's a quote. And yet he repeated them to officials and to the public.
Well,
and
so there's said she was crazy.
Well, yes. And I think there's a lot of focus on, I've seen a lot of claims that he's being prosecuted for his speech, but I think the reason they go into so many details about all of the different things that they categorize as lies is to show the intent. And him knowing that what he said was false is a part of the intent. I don't think he's actually being indicted for what he said or even for the lies. But I think it is important to establish that I think he knows they were lies. I just think that he has this complex about being a winner. He'll never admit to being a loser, and losing an election makes him a loser. I think it's all his ego. I don't actually believe that he's insane on that level, because that's what this defense would be. It would be an insanity offense.
I don't.
I think he really thought he won, but I think it's immaterial. If I was convinced that Justin had stolen from me, and I went over to Justin's house and I stole stuff, and it was because I truly thought that he had stolen something from me and I was setting the record straight, I am still stealing stuff. I'm still breaking the law. And so if he thought the election was rigged against him and he tried to rig the election.
If I stole a bunch of stuff from you and then somebody told you that if you bury all your furniture in your front yard, Justin will give all your stuff back, and then you did that, then that would not be illegal. The question is whether or not this is illegal. And that the question is whether or not this false slate of electors thing is illegal. And right now we don't have precedent because no one's fucking done it before.
I think Andrew's nailed it on the fraud. I just think the fraud is so obvious.
Well, obviously I'm trying to make a point. I guess it's not being taken.
Well, Justin, I think your point is well met in that I've been consistently anti-Trump guy for a long time. And in the anti-Trump camp, we get really caught up in burning the effigies of Donald Trump. And like, I am aware that one of my cognitive blind spots is that I have it out for the guy. And so when he does something good, it's difficult for me to see it. I'm not saying any of that's happening right now. And I also get really sidetracked by his rhetoric and I get lost on policy. I think there's a ton of us that do that. And so in a situation like this, there is almost certainly going to be a kind of torch wielding herd mentality to just get the bad guy. That's something that we should be aware of. It's definitely present.
This is it. This is different.
And the bigger issue that you are right to be concerned about is, what is the precedent here? And will this be weaponized against people that are good, that are doing the right thing, right? So like the concern that in the future, Al Gore or George W. Bush type people contesting an election that has some weird results will be jailed. That is a big concern. We should be on the lookout for that. It is, I got to say, not sufficient for me to go, well, no harm, no foul. I still think that setting a precedent of you are going to be punished for attempting to break the election of the American people, I think that's also a precedent. So I don't think that there's really a way for us to just go, we're not going to deal with this. I think we have to deal with it. And you know, I'm for moving forward on it. And you're again, your position's well met, but I think we got to go.
Justin, I have one question for you as the host of Politics. Mm-hmm. How excited are you for this trial? With the quotes that came out already, like the campaign staff saying that these were conspiracies beamed down from the mothership, and Trump telling Mike Pence that you're too honest, like, how much fun is this going to be?
Not at all. It's all old. It's we've done it.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're
it's
no
so
old.
Justin, can I tell you my theory on how this plays out?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, like that's the problem with all of this, is that it's like, this is like I'm meeting my European cousins who are telling me about this new show, Seinfeld. It's like, look, I'm not saying that it's not wild. Like, I'm just saying just because it's airing for the first time in Yugoslavia doesn't mean that I haven't already seen the Soup Nazi episode. Trust me, you'll love the Sponges one.
So here's where I think this is going to get crazy. And Justin, you being the true politics analyst, I'm curious what you think of this. First of all, I don't know what the timeline is on this. I haven't been able to determine that.
I do think this is going to go a lot faster than the Florida case. The judge is far more sympathetic to the prosecutor, and B, it's in D.C. And let me say again, because regardless of what I think about this personally, and we haven't even gotten into the political ramifications, I think he's going to get convicted. I think that Donald Trump gets convicted in Washington, D.C. For this crime. I believe that that is the case. I believe it ends up in the Supreme Court, and I believe he gets off there.
So here's what I think happens. I think that this conviction, it'll have to be breakneck speed to occur before the election. Possible. I mean, I think that the prosecutor very intentionally streamlined this case in order to make it fast. The fact that none of the co-conspirators are named, I think that's just to make this an easier right down the pike process so that we don't have to drag them into it. So he's hoping to get it done very quickly. Even noting that, I think that the Trump team is, one, going to be able to suck all the oxygen out of the room. There is now no way any Republican candidate will have even the slightest ability to mount an offense against him and challenge him for the nomination. He already was winning in the polls.
I think that people aren't going to give a fuck about this?
They already don't.
No. They will give a fuck. They will give a fuck that this is a politically weaponized persecution from the Biden administration to eliminate his biggest threat. Yep. That's what they will care about because that's what they've cared about thus far.
Also, if I can give Trump a true genius for anything, it's being able to wield media attention to suit his ends. And so this ensures a Trump candidacy. This is all this does is bake him in.
Nomination. A Trump nomination. Not a candidacy, but a nomination.
I really hope you guys are wrong. I mean, in this debate, he's already chickening out of it. I know Pence is going to bring it up. Chris Christie's going to bring it up. I think this is going to be a bigger deal in the Republican Party. I mean, one of the people that got tricked was Ronna Romney McDaniels, Mitt Romney's niece, but also the head of the RNC. The senators are very quiet about this. They're not defending Trump at all. Like, I think things are turning within the Republican Party. At least I hope they are. But I just, as someone who has Republicans in my family, I really want to hope that they're better than this. Because if his support goes up after this story, I can't.
Jen, get ready. I didn't even say the thing that I was really thinking is going to happen. You ready for my Heaton's crazy theory of how this plays out?
Is this going to kill me? Am I going to want to hang myself after I hear this,
to be honest with you? So Pence clearly is not going to be the running mate for Trump if he takes the nomination. If I were Donald Trump, do you know who I would pick?
MTG.
RFK Jr. RFK Jr. does very well with Republicans. He's an anti-establishment candidate. And if Trump is sucking all the oxygen out of the room at a court trial being persecuted, I can't think of a better person to be his running mate going around making speeches. And I think he has a very, very good chance of winning if that is the case and then pardoning himself. So we might very well have a thing where Trump's in jail for like a week, is elected president with RFK Jr. as his vice president, pardons himself, and the sitcom resumes for season 4.
I don't think RFK would do it. No, I don't. I mean, I've heard him speak. Like I said,
he's had negative things to say about Trump.
Yeah, he has. And I think he really does care about the country. I don't think, especially after this, that he would want to be the guy that says, I'm going to partner up with, I just don't see it.
I would have said the same thing about Mike Pence back about this time in 2016.
Yeah, so, but in 2016, this hadn't happened. Like, I don't think that I'm one of those people that's can be described as anti-Trump because I read the Mueller report. Reported that he didn't do it, watched both impeachment inquiries, hearings, whatever, said I would acquit him. Like, I think I'm pretty good at looking at him and just being like, okay, this is fair. This isn't. And I really didn't have a Trump is a danger to the democracy. In fact, I made fun of that for years. Even after January 6th, I mean, we were on the air during January 6th. I was never calling it an insurrection. That pissed me off. But this fake electors thing is my bridge too far. That's my bridge too far. And I think it's going to be the case for a lot of people.
I think he's going to be the nominee. I think with each indictment, he has gone up 5 to 10%. I think that, this is something for which has been baked in to our political calculus for 2 years now. And we've spent a lot of time on it, more time on it than most Americans want to spend. Whether or not he will be convicted for it is a legal matter, not a political matter. But if we are just looking at it politically, I don't know that there is new juice to be squeezed out of January 6th. I think it has been wrung as tightly as you can.
Well, maybe if we keep referring to it as January 6th, but I think we need to start talking about the fake elector scheme because that's.
Look, if we want to really get into the larger issue about this, this is the same thing I think about COVID, where what we have been so brain poisoned politically that we have not gone back and looked at exactly what happened with the roots of COVID and, and everything that happened, our culpability for it. We have not done a bipartisan blue ribbon. Let's actually just open up the books and see what happened so the American people can know what it was. I will say the exact same thing about this 2020 election, up to and including everything that happened with Donald Trump and the fake electors. But let's go back and understand that a lot of state by state voting rules were changed in ways that we still don't know whether or not that jibed with their state constitutions, that they were being done for public health measures and then stayed around. I think that politically, Donald Trump was an absolute loser face with loser sauce for not understanding what his problems that he later claimed would be conspiracy theories were going to be before the election, because that's how people actually win, is by challenging these things legally before you go vote. You don't wait until after the scoreboard is at 000 to bitch about the fact that the refs were crooked, whether or not you think that they were. If you want to win, that's how you do it. And then building all the way up through January 6th, where we had two pipe bombs placed at the RNC and DNC, for which nobody seems to care about anymore, despite the fact that it was actually the reason why all of the congressional offices were emptied. I think that there's a lot that we should look into. And while I'm happy that we are looking into the Trump fake elector thing, I do think that this, to me, while I was watching it in real time, felt the exact same thing to me that it feels or then that it does now. It was the Apple dumpling gang of rejects, the only lackeys who wouldn't tell Donald Trump no. So not only did the Republican establishment that's been around forever, many of them told him no before or after he got elected president. They came back and then many of them filtered out. Then it was the MAGA faithful. They eventually told him no. Then it was just the 2020 hardcores that thought that they were going to be the people that would ride off into the sunset with a two-term MAGA president. They told him no. Who was left? New York Yankees enthusiast Rudy Giuliani, the Kraken inventor of fan fiction Sidney Powell, and everybody else who just assumed maybe buying into Donald Trump's worldview, which this is what I genuinely believe. I know we all model Donald Trump's brain in our heads, and it's part of the reason why we're fascinated with him and we want to either praise him or punish him. But Donald Trump believes that winning and losing is subjective, that losing is just saying you're not trying to win anymore. And if you are not going to the absolute ends of when everybody else is quitting, that's what makes losers losers and winners winners, is that losers eventually say, I'm not trying to win. And what he did was, again, what I find to be repulsive, morally repugnant, and I will even go so far as to say, depending on your worldview, evil, if you are find the American democratic system to be sacred. And I don't know if it's illegal. That's the only thing for which, because we've never seen anything like this before. And so I think he'll be convicted in DC. I think it will go to the Supreme Court. I think that that will happen after the 2024 election is determined. But if we're looking at just the political ramifications right now, I believe it will be very, very, very remote any chance that, barring a health crisis for Donald Trump, that he is not the 2024 Republican nominee.
Yeah, I think this cinches the nomination.
Well, the only prediction of the future that I'm willing to make is that I think that this trial is going to be covered like the OJ trial. I think we're going to see very famous people on the witness stand, and it's going to be entertaining. That's as far as I'm willing to go.
So you're pumped. You're excited.
I mean, yes, I am. I'll be honest, because just like the cast of characters here, there's so many ridiculous people involved. And in this indictment, we did get a little bit of new information. We got some information from like Mike Pence's notes. We got information from Mark Meadows' emails. Like this, they have more than what we heard in the January 6th committee from people that were closer to the situation. And yeah, I just think it's going to be fascinating to learn the details. I think this is going to make one hell of a Netflix movie. I don't know. I just think that as far as campaigns are concerned, I hate campaign season. I have told you guys this many times. I find it insufferable. So if this kind of replaces a lot of the just he said, she said garbage. I would so much rather watch this trial than politics. So yeah, I welcome this in 2024.
Oh no. But the primaries are the only fun part of American political discourse, because the primaries are the one time where the knuckle dragging partisans of both teams are actually willing to laugh at themselves. I've say from a political satire standpoint, like from August to October is the only period I enjoy, because I can crack jokes about Republicans, and all the Republicans other than the specific Republican I'm cracking jokes about will laugh, ditto the Democrats. And the thing that I think is invaluable to that process, which sadly is almost certainly going to be lost in the Republican side this time, is you actually get to see the real fault lines in the American electorate. We perhaps we'll get into this in the next story, but we have this ridiculous fantasy that there's one of two viewpoints for 360 million people, which is utter bullshit. The Democratic Party is like six or seven parties that all have a donkey emblem. The Republican Party is five or six parties that have an elephant emblem, but they're different. Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden are different species of Democrats. Mike Pence and Donald Trump, who in my mind basically formed a coalitional government within the Republican Party, are different. The primaries are fun because you actually get to see those debates in the parties before they all get lockstep, and you get to see where the real differences in ideology and policy are.
Well, I guess we'll be watching two different channels, because I have no interest in it. I want to watch.
No. This one's over. This one's over. The Department of Justice has ensured that the Republican primary is over.
I know that I shouldn't, but I have more faith in the Republican voters than that. I think someone else will be the nominee in the Republican Party. Someone will step forward and say this is unacceptable. And I think Republican voters with their primary votes will say, we're done with this shit. I really believe that.
This is a weird way for me to shill for the Republicans here. I don't think the majority of the Republicans that are fine with Trump doing this think I am fine with Trump stealing an election. That's not what they're thinking. They are literally thinking that the game is rigged, that it was a fraudulent election, and that he was fighting on behalf of the American people to save the true will of the people against the establishment. But they don't see it as our guy lost and then he decided to flip the table over and we just want our guy to win. I think they truly think, the most of them think, that the game was rigged and he was trying to undo it, or that it's this, you know, horrible swamp, et cetera, et cetera. But I will happily say that they have been misled by the meat goblin of Florida, and that they are laboring under delusions. I don't think that vociferous passion they have is coming from a bad place, weirdly. Like they think that they are trying to save democracy.
I don't think that they represent the entire Republican voter base. I think there are plenty of people in the Republican Party that believe in low taxes and limited government and don't buy into this MAGA bullshit. And I think they will show up and vote for someone else. So at least that's my hope.
I share your hope.
Well, wish in one hand, shit in the other.
Thank you, Justin.
Patreon.com/wherenotwrong. This week, we'll be talking about the rise in people avoiding the news. So in case you are turned off by this entire conversation, please understand that you are not in the wrong. Patreon.com/wherenotwrong is where you go. Support us and get a bonus episode each and every week. In fact, let me take a live look here. I think we're still over 900. Usually there's a little burp in the Patreon. Yeah. So we're just around 900 again now. So we're going to keep climbing to summit Mount 1000 with your help. Thank you very much. Patreon.com/wherenotwrong. Let's talk about high school boys, huh?
Yeah.
Annual surveys over the last 3 years, roughly one quarter of high school seniors self-identified as conservative or very conservative on the Monitoring the Future survey, a scholarly endeavor that dates to the 1970s. Only 13% of boys identified as liberal or very liberal in those years. The figures represent a striking shift in the views of the political views of boys. As recently as the late 2000s, liberal boys occasionally outnumbers conservatives. And back in the Carter era, both boys and girls leaned
liberal. Nowadays, it's girls who are drifting to the left, with a share of 12th grade girls who identified as liberal rising from 19% in 2012 to 30% in 2020. Only 12% of girls identified as conservative in last year's survey administered by the University of Michigan. Mr. Andrew Heaton, presuming this is accurate, why might we think this is happening?
I think this whole thing makes a lot more sense if you take out the word conservative and liberal and put in the word red team and blue team. Then this whole thing makes sense. The problem that I had with this story is that it the implication is that there's some sort of philosophy that these high school students are gravitating towards, which I do not think is accurate. I think the idea that there is something inherent to this term conservative or inherent to this term liberal goes back the same and means the same thing during the Carter years. That's not true. My guess is, well, I wasn't able to crack the data on this. I tried finding the publication itself and I had a difficult time doing it. My guess is if you were to poll those same people about how do you feel about gay marriage, you would find that both the purported red team and blue team people would be generally in favor of it. And if you were to go back to Jimmy Carter, you'd find both of them would be against it, because these terms conservative and progressive, while you can pick one or two things that they actually mean something by, you could, you know, it means small government or big government or something like that. When you start expanding it out to mean everything that we're talking about, like Ukraine and abortion and jurisprudence and all these things that are unrelated to each other, it becomes a temporary shopping cart of ideas. And the red team, blue team thing is what's going on. And so in that capacity, the boys in these high schools are like, yes, I feel more red team than blue team, perhaps because they're turned off by wokeness or they're watching Steven Crowder or something like that. But it's not as if they're all like reading John Locke or Milton Friedman or Saul, what's the guy that wrote the Rules for Radicals or whatever. The bit that's left out that I actually think is more interesting to this, because who knows how these boys would define conservative. They probably all mean different things by it. They might well mean different things than what we mean by it. What I found interesting was that I think 2/5 of them didn't pick a side. That to me is far more interesting, because if I had to make a guess, when I was in high school, I was very much an extension of my parents' politics. I don't think I would have espoused this at the time, but in retrospect, I was just a loyal member of the Heaton family and I was carrying the torch of what the Heaton said. My guess is most high school students do the exact same thing. I find it more interesting that 2/5 of the boys did not feel that they were on either side and elected to not say that, which I think is a great sign of hope that the incoming generation might have some amount of emotional independence from the red team versus blue team thing.
That does seem to be shrinking, though. That is a shrinking number. People are more identifying as one side or the other.
Yeah. I think that the boys coming there is a temporary thing. And it probably has more to do with right now wokeness and perceived, you know, patriarchy versus anti-patriarchy. That's my guess for boys in high school. But I would, again, like really advise everybody to remember that there's no coherent conservative or liberal position on foreign policy. It changes from president to president. There's no coherent liberal or conservative policy on free trade versus protectionism. For a while, the Republicans were pro-free trade. The progressives were against it. And then they both were for it in the 90s. And now the conservatives are kind of against it. Like, it's all a grab bag. Because what we're really talking about, we're just talking about teams and tribal identities. We're talking about a totem pole with a sigil on top of an elephant or a donkey, and which one you want to root for at the Super Bowl. And there's lots of different reasons that could be happening. But whenever I read these things about how the incoming generation is going to be more liberal or more conservative, I think it's horseshit. I think that there are trends that are happening in terms of the Overton window, but there's always this tendency. People always want to do this thing where they're like, the incoming generation, they're going to be super liberal. It's the end of the Republicans. And like, if any group ever, just because we're so tribalistic, we so badly want to have somebody to fight. If there ever were a party that managed to really dominate, it would end up splitting in half and fighting itself. So I think that this does not beckon any type of massive tidal wave that you can see manifest when they become of age at 18.
Jim, what's up with these boys?
Well, so Andrew, I agree with you completely on those terms, liberal and conservative, having lost all useful meaning. And so I'm totally with you on, we should look at this as team red and team blue. And, you know, it was interesting when you sent that article, because there was a graph in it that I found myself staring at for a while. And it seems like the hard split happened right around 2016, which happens to be mm-hmm. when Team Blue ran a candidate whose slogan was, "I'm with her." And I remember, as a woman, being attacked by so many people, being told that I'm a traitor to my gender because I didn't vote for her, even though I voted for Jill Stein, who happens to have a vagina. I took so much shit. I think so. Yeah. And yet I am a traitor for not voting for her.
Bold stance to say that identifies a woman. Bigot.
I know, right? And so that's a lot of it too, right? Ever since 2016, which was an election which she decided to run on gender. Gender has been such a topic in this country in a way that it's like men versus women. And you see people like Joe Rogan, who's being branded on team conservative because he stands up for men and has, you know, tells people to work out and talks about kettlebells and shit. And all of a sudden he's a conservative, even though he said he would vote for Bernie and like self-identifies as a liberal all the time on his show. So I think those terms have got muddled, but I think Team Red is the one that is going with the message that it's okay to be a man. It's okay to be proud to be a man. And so I think that's why young kids are gravitating towards that message, because Team Blue, ever since I'm with her, you know, there's a focus on gender in a way that has told people that there's something wrong with being a man. And I don't think that message resonates with young boys.
Yeah, I think you're probably right about that.
Man, this is great. This is going to be the episode where I disagree with both of you guys on both topics. I don't think that it is red versus blue. I do think that there are liberal and conservative positions that are not tied to political parties. I think that political parties try to take advantage of trends that are happening naturally and not the other way around. I don't believe that they start them. I believe that when Hillary Clinton went with her I'm with her slogan, it was because there was a rise in a certain level of we can do it feminism and a coalition of young women and older women for whom had been on the precipice of this kind of achievement. And they thought that it would be more beneficial to them to get more people into a booth to hit a button. And it was not a programming for which everybody is either going to react to or not react to. It was a marketing slogan that they assumed would tap into deeper reservoirs. And that is something that I think we are seeing in these kind of trends. There are sociological conversations that are happening that have that politics takes their marching orders from, that I do think are either conservative or liberal. We have, especially on ideas of sex and gender, like you brought up, Jen, we are in a particularly liberal and progressive age where we are looking to create new definitions of what sex and gender are. And regardless of where you stand in that particular conversation, if the conservative position is, well, a man is a man and a woman is a woman, or something that is closer to the way we would define sex and gender in the 1990s or early 2000s, if that's now conservative, then yeah, I think you're probably going to see a lot of boys for which identify more with that than with a larger, more expansive idea of let's just say sex and gender specifically. I think if we look at conservative and liberal in the way that Heaton looks at it, which is from a very educated understanding of spectrums of the role of the state and economics and all the things for which you would that Heaton would define it is pockets square resplendent as ever, this has nothing to do with that. I think that this has to do with more which you know, VTuber they're watching and whether or not they are reacting to an Andrew Tate video or a Greta Thunberg blog post.
I don't think we're in disagreement. I mean, I would say that this is like what we would call effective polarization as opposed to like philosophical polarization. It is about which team you identify with. And I think you both make excellent points. If I were a high school student right now, I think I would feel a little bit embattled as a white guy. There is this sort of like,
you heard him, get him.
Yeah, there is this kind of like, well, like, I mean, not from everybody, but from certain quarters that have a fair amount of media presence, all of my defaults are bad. There is a kind of collective guilt. I remember that, like, even in high school, kind of being like, I don't feel like I should be judged based on other men. Like there was that kind of like antipathy to being judged collectively based on identity, which I don't think was nearly as strong back then, but I think is a lot stronger now. And I could see how that would turn people off.
Well, I think the question is whether or not where you identify. And I do think that these kind of polls, and there's a reason why it made the show today, because kind of in the news desert. Not a lot of news happens in August.
Power plant opened up last week.
Yeah, look at that.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Where? Get your merch. Where's the merch drop? Yeah, I believe it took like 30 years to get approved or something. There was some.
Yeah, the approval process was pretty drawn out. Yeah,
drawn out. But yeah, I mean, I think that there's a reason why we have these kind of conversations. I totally agree with you, Heaton, on the pushback on this, that it signifies demographics or destiny, that it signifies that there is a gigantic swing back to the Republican Party from young men, or it has some generational portent for American politics. I totally agree with you there. I've lived long enough to watch four or five of these kinds of prophecies.
You lived through the permanent Republican majority. Remember that temporary period?
Permanent Republican majority, the permanent Democratic majority when the Browning of America happened. Right. And it's like, oh no, guess what? Now more brown people are conservative. So shocker. It didn't work out the way that some people thought. We tend to assume the future is just a larger version of today, when in reality, the future tends to shift gradually, but eventually when you look back, you're like, oh, wow, 2023 looks a lot different than 2020. It looks a lot different in a lot of the way that we're having these conversations. And some people, and whether or not it's because we are hiding our true nature to feel more in line with what the marching orders of today are, or we always have. And it's just a matter of where the microscope is. Who knows? I'll leave that up to philosophers and sociologists.
That reminds me, in 2016, the anti-Trump protest on the weekend of the inauguration, that was the women's march, too.
It was the women's march.
With the pussy hats, which I thought was the dumbest political. Like, I'm a pretty consistent anti-Trump guy, and I'd like to think of myself as pro-vagina. But if somebody said, why don't you put this vagina hat on? And I'd be like, you know, I'm more of a pocket square guy. And they were like, you're sexist. I'd go, how about fuck yourself? I like wearing pocket squares, not hats that look like vaginas. Feel the same way about penis hats, incidentally. I don't like wearing genitals on my head. I thought that was the dumbest marketing move.
Yeah. And that's what Team Blue has been up to. So I think men who want to feel masculine are like, do I want to be on that team? Like, especially a 16-year-old, it doesn't seem cool.
This also gets into something that we're going to talk about in the Patreon episode, plug patreon.com/we're not wrong. But I think, and we're going to get into it in our media conversation, that we've been, our conversations have been dominated by activists for the last 5 to 7 years. And I don't think that it's necessarily their fault. I think that they're doing the same thing that they've always done. It's just that some of the degradation of our media systems and the rise of social media has given more amplified voice to activist perspectives, which again, I'm not against. I think that they have a place. I think that they have been overrepresented in certain elements. And so if activism by its very nature is pointing out that something is on fire, sometimes whether or not it is, then that means that we get more and more of a hysterical perspective. And if the point is, hey, women have it hard, and that morphs into white people and white men specifically have an innate evilness that is poisoning the world, then like you're going to get pushback to that. You're going to incentivize in a more hysterical world, more hysterical voices that fight back against it. And that's why we have like the Steven Crowders and the Andrew Tates of the world, the hyper masculine, you should only eat meat. And if a woman tries to talk to you, you should click four times because it confuses their brain. Like that type of dialogue happens in a world where men feel threatened by a power structure for which they feel is out of control and out to get them.
I agree with that. I think that that's all accurate. I'll add that I think part of the play on identity politics also boils down to just how Democrats and Republicans alternately organize. And I think a tremendous amount of crosstalk in our country results from this otherwise benign phenomenon. By and large, the Democratic Party tends to organize and understand itself as its constituent components. So it's unions, teachers, minorities, groups like that. And they're very concerned with taking care of all of the constituencies they're in. The Republicans traditionally, Trump is a very, very big asterisk to what I'm about to say. The Republicans traditionally ran on ideology and not so much on constituencies. So they were all running on, I am the reincarnation of Reagan. I am the true conservative. You watch Republican primaries going back 20 years. It's who's the real conservative, who's not the real conservative. You don't really see that in Democratic circles of like, you're a fake Democrat. Who's the true Democrat? Who's more Democrat? Because that's not how they're processing stuff. And I think that the result of this is, I didn't come up with this. Matt Grossman, who's been on my show, told me this, and I think he's onto something, is that Republicans typically look at the Democrats and infer an ideological agenda where there is none. They look at somebody like Joe Biden, who I think very much thinks in terms of constituency groups of I'm the labor guy and I have blacks on my side, et cetera, et cetera. He thinks very much in terms of they look at Biden and well, now they think he's, you know, senile. But 5 years ago, they would have looked at Biden and said he's, you know, a crypto socialist. He's reading Saul Alinsky. They very much thought Obama was this like crypto communist character. And I think the Democrats on the flip side infer a identity agenda where there is none with the Republicans on a regular basis, where they look at the Republicans and go, well, we all are thinking about our constituent groups, African-Americans and Latinx and LGBTQ, et cetera, et cetera. And they're always saying crap about ideology. So that's got to be bullshit. It really has to be about white men. They're secretly the white men party and they're just lying to us about it. And like, no, I think the Republicans would have been perfectly happy with Sarah Palin versus Obama. I think that they are more concerned about that. And some of this manifests what we're seeing right now of this, you know, literal pink versus blue gender type stuff that comes out of that identity based campaigning.
Well, we'll all have to wait and see. We're not wrongpod at gmail.com. Presenting you with the illusion of access. We're not wrongpod at gmail.com. New Phrases writes, last week, while discussing the potential future of AnchorSteam as an employee-owned co-op, Andrew Heaton combined the phrases more power to them and hats off to them to say more hats to them. I will now be entering this into my day-to-day usage wherever I can. I listened to this show back and I also flagged that and I was so excited that somebody caught it. To you, New Phrases, more hats.
Hey, more hats to you. More hats to you.
More hats to you. I just love the idea of just Heaton spamming infinite hats. He just has a gigantic, like outstretched arm and 50 caps of all different varieties. Fedoras, ball caps, whatever have you. Fezzes, just all over, strewn about the land.
Hey, Justin, usually I read the mail in advance. I forgot to do it this week. Is it steamy? Because I have nothing prepared.
No. I think okay. It's
you
fine.
Read them in advance. I like. Never
I presume you guys never read these. So, no. Follow the money writes, just as it would be naive to believe that Joe Biden was the only politician China and Ukraine bought and sold. It would easily, or it would be equally naive to think that the NSA deep state military industrial spy complex also don't have the details of Joe Biden's phone calls, bank accounts, and money trail. How many masters does Joe answer to? Where's the outrage? Hell, where's the curiosity? Jen Briney.
I feel like people have been talking about this stuff for a long time. So where's the outrage and curiosity? It's been going on for 20 years. It's there. I mean, we're all concerned about the NSA spying. We have been since, I mean, I remember hearing about the Utah data center. This must have been like 2005, where they were collecting everything and storing it in Utah. This was the George W. Bush administration. There were people protesting. They ended up closing it down. There are plenty of people outraged, but at a certain point after 20 years, like, I don't know. I've been getting a lot of shit online after our last conversation about just being like, I don't know about Hunter Biden. I'll wait until the investigation's done. You can't run around being outraged about everything all the time. So at a certain point, you just gotta, it's happening. Like, I don't know.
Jen, America would disagree with you.
Yes.
Yeah, the outrage is there. It's just, what are we supposed to do about it?
Follow the money too. Double the money, writes Andrew. You had some questions about why agents might come forward. These are the IRS agents for the whistleblowers. All federal law enforcement agents are forced to retire at the age of 57, so they probably have more years behind them than they do in front of them at this point. The cynical take would be that they're looking to have a book deal in retirement, or my completely unfounded conspiracy theory, the IRS sent them to curry favor with Republicans, so maybe they'll stop trying to defund the agency. After all, two of the 2,000 armed IRS agents were looking for the truth regarding the Biden's criminal conspiracy.
That's such a good point. The Republicans were like, these heroes from the IRS. I've never heard them so pro-IRS in my life. That's funny.
Listener, that is all impossible because, as we know, when people enter government service, they lose all career motivations in favor of the public good. So ipso facto, this is impossible.
Beer historian writes, prior to Prohibition, there were only three truly American-made beer styles. Louisville's Kentucky Common, which barely exists anymore. Cincinnati's Cream Ale, modernly popularized by Little Kings. And San Francisco's California Common, or Steam Beer, modernly popularized by Anchor. Anchor is a historically significant brand to American beer history. It'd be great if it were owned by the workers. Also, they have national distribution and are reasonably popular outside of San Francisco.
More hats.
More hats. Anchor's Away writes, it's not on tap around here, that is Anchor Steam, but I could get Anchor in Pittsburgh. A highlight was their Christmas beer with a unique recipe each year. I'm glad to have a photo with my last Anchor purchased, and they sent it, so that's nice.
Wah, wah.
IP Anus writes, I disagree with your contention that IPAs are popular. IPAs are easier to brew than better types of beer, and the metric shit ton of hops, originally added to prevent the beer from spoiling on the voyage to India, keeps it from going bad on the shelf. I feel like these factors lead to a lot of startup breweries to make IPAs. Then it sells because it's available, so they take that as a sign that more people want it. Conversely, people buy them because they're available and don't investigate other beer types, so breweries make more of them.
I like this conspiracy theory.
Completely correct to me. That all sounds right. Like who's making the IPA? New breweries. Who doesn't want to drink it? Me, when I can drink Pilsner as an alternative. Who drank it? Younger me, when I didn't have Pilsner as an alternative and didn't know what I was up to. I think you're probably right on all counts.
Well, and I have a bunch of people in my life that are trying to convince me that IPAs taste good and they just don't. So like knowing that it's a preservative that makes them taste shitty, I think it's just a fad. And so you have these people that are like, oh, I love IPAs. I love IPAs too. It's like the same brainworms that made everyone run out and see the Barbie movie and Oppenheimer. It's like something becomes a fad and everyone jumps on board. And I think this whole IPA thing has to be that because they taste awful.
I agree. The same reason why people went to go see Barbie and Oppenheimer, well-deserved hype over well-made product that became deservedly popular. Both those movies are good. They got a reputation for the right reasons. IPAs are delicious. I don't know why people have this hate on them.
They're
just
gross.
Let me drink my IPAs in peace. That's beautiful. I've never offered you an IPA in my life. I've never forced any of my friends to drink an IPA. And yet, much like CrossFitters and vegans, it is the IPA haters of this world that bring it up fucking constantly.
Justin has tackled me on his lawn and, using a funnel normally appropriated for adding oil into an engine, shoved an IPA down my gullet. It was terrible. That happened last week, even though I'm in Scotland.
Even though you're in Scotland.
I was going to say I was a witness, but I'm in Mexico, so it's
no, fuck it. Fine. Yeah, let's go. Let's get we can get Jack Smith to indict me too. Do I hear $100,000 writes Jello Biafra, formerly of the Dead Kennedys, once ran for mayor in San Francisco against Dianne Feinstein. One plank of his platform was to formalize corruption that already existed by holding public auctions for government appointments. We should absolutely do this for the federal government because prices convey valuable information, such as the market rate for the ambassadorship of Albania and the utter sham of representative democracy.
I have to apologize because I didn't hear any of that past the first name of this dude is Jello. Like,
you're not a Dead Kennedys fan. You should know this as an East Bay person. He's like famous.
I'm not an East Bay person. I tried to fit in there. I didn't. Jello, like J-E-L-L-O.
Yeah. Dead Kennedys. Have you ever heard of the Dead Kennedys?
I've heard of the Dead Kennedys. I just didn't know there was a dude named Jello.
He's the guy. He's the lead singer of the Dead Kennedys.
Now, was he born before the pudding? Like, what came first, the pudding or the dude?
I believe that was a stage name based on the product.
Okay, so it's a stage name. He's not actually named Jello.
I believe Jello Biafra is a stage name. Please hold and I'll double check.
So no, it was 100%. The point of whatever this kind soul wrote in.
Eric Reed Boucher is his name. Okay. Jello Biafra is his stage name. And I once saw him DJing at Forbidden Island, the tiki bar on Alameda.
I love that place. I had my birthday party there once.
Maybe you saw him DJing and you didn't know you were in the presence of Jello Biafra.
I didn't know because I was blacked out.
Yeah. I'll tell you what. You only need one or two of those and they will put you on your ass. California Uber Alice. That's like, it's a classic song. The Dead Kennedys, fantastic. But Jello Biafra, yeah, he's very, very politically minded and motivated. And
named Eric. Time,
speaking of being faced in Oakland or in the East Bay, one time I was at the end of a Hood Slam night and I was just different planet. And all of a sudden Jello Biafra comes out. It was Arno Kor who you saw when you were in the Bay Area for that Hood Slam show. It was an Arno Kor night and Jello Biafra just comes running out and sings California Uber Alice. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure this is happening.
That's so fun.
Yeah.
Very cool.
It was an amazing night. What do you think? Formalized by auction, all ambassadorships. This is a bugaboo of yours.
It would never work because, as I previously pointed out, all public servants are good-hearted and have no personal motivations. So as long as they're within the overall governmental apparatus, everything's fine. You just got to pluck the couple of evil people.
Denying us Ernest Heaton earns you Andrew Heaton's Flaming Sports Hot Takes, brought to you by Sports. Hit the sounder. Heaton, smart for Porzingis?
Absolutely. Porzingis is one of the best fares you can purchase to eat at a stadium. And I think the Polish community, man, there's so many contributions they've made to our great country, both in the realm of cuisine and sports. And there's no greater example of those two things combining in a way to benefit everybody than Porzingis.
You're not worried about Boston's heart?
You know what? What you make Porzingis out of varies quite a lot from region to region. And, you know, there is some heart-based Porzingis that's a little bit stout for me. But, you know, if you're from the East Coast, maybe you're into that kind of thing.
And you don't think that the extension for Kristaps was too rich?
I found a little on the rich side, yeah. But, what are you going to do when you're eating Porzingis? Sometimes it's going to be a bit rich. You don't want your stomach to be bigger than your eyes to be bigger than your stomach when you're putting that Porzingis in your mouth.
So I think Celtics fans will hope that Porzingis will be put in the mouth of many of their opponents throughout the next season. So there is a player for the Boston Celtics named Jaylen Brown, and Jaylen Brown just signed a gigantic extension, despite the fact that he has not been a good playoff performer when it matters the most. And apparently, I think the internet found this out, that Ben Shapiro, the conservative commentator, is a Boston Celtics fan, and one of the one of the knocks on Jaylen Brown is that he cannot dribble to his left. That people defenses will force him to move left, and he tends to turn the ball over when that happens
in basketball.
And so in basketball, Ben Shapiro says all that money for a guy who can't go left, and the response that I think he retweeted was, in his defense, you can't either. So that was pretty funny. Still wouldn't be longer than CVS writes. It just occurred to me that I get a receipt from the grocery store that says 72 ounces of beer I just bought cost me 18 cents each. Yet I have no fucking clue where any of the pennies I pay in taxes go. Should it be the government's obligation to supply me with a detailed receipt for my purchases of government this year? What would that receipt even look like?
There's a website that they created in the last 10 years. Is it governmentspending.gov, something like that? But there actually is a website where we're supposed to see where our money goes, at least, like, not in the Pentagon, obviously.
Theoretically, no, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
but that does exist.
I can tell you right now where your money went, listener. So it's 18 cents, about eight of them, six of them went to something good in your state, you know, like a school or a fire department or something. And then two of them went to graft, and 10 were just pissed away for fun. So the breakdown, something like that. What I think would be a fun mental experiment that would be interesting for democracy would be this. Rather than giving everybody an itemized breakdown of what your percentage of your taxes is, which is typically how we think of this, is if we treated it as just a fungible thing, which it is. And by that, I mean, we went, all of your taxes bill this year went to the Commission on Public Safety in Iowa. That's it. Everything. Thank you for your contribution to the Commission on Public Safety in Iowa. George, all of your taxes this year went to purchasing tanks in Ukraine. Whatever that is, right? So like just, and then I think you'd be able to like pretty quickly go, I don't think I should have had my income put towards that. Or alternately, you could go, no, that's a good use of my income.
Yeah, I think we tend to, and this is a benefit of being a very rich country in general, we tend to just kind of assume that all of our money is being spent well. And so if we really care about something, the way that we care about it is by just giving it more money, because that's what we do to things that we like the most, is just give it more money, whether or not it is like, wait, hold on. Like, how much we're spending on what? Like there's not really a lot of that. We tend to do that a little bit more with our own finances than we do with tax conversations, where it's just, I love it more. And that may or may not be great for the things that we really love.
Mm-hmm.
This one's a long one. Brace yourself. Sting of the Hornet writes, I no longer live in the state of Georgia. However, I did grow up there, and I'm still connected with the goings-on of the North Atlanta suburbs of my youth. While our esteemed representative now represents the 14th district, this is not the district that Marjorie Taylor Greene came from, nor the district she first ran in. MTG is a 6th district girly. She moved to GA 14 specifically to run there. A short while ago, my mother's coworkers were going through her old yearbook, and whose photograph does she stumble upon but one of our finest members of Congress? However, this is no ordinary yearbook. This is a Milton High School yearbook. For those of you not in the know, there exists a great rivalry here in the state of Georgia between Milton High School, those rich, pompous snobs with their fancy new buildings and adequate funding for after-school activities, and the esteemed, gentle everyman's Roswell High School. If you've ever seen a movie where the central conflict is two towns where two rival football teams play each other, and you think to yourself, that's not realistic. No one would ever care that much about a high school football rivalry. then you, my friend, have never been to a Roswell Milton game. Many of our greatest triumphs have been played out on that gridiron, as well as many of our greatest defeats. My point is that all of MTG's worst behavior can be explained by the fact that she is a Milton Eagle. Her entitlement to run in an easy election, her constant sucking up to party leadership, her brash media appearances, all learned behavior from Milton. That's right, she wasn't born that way. Rather, she was forged into the bitter, fiery congresswoman that we all love to hate by the public high school in the town next to me. I would just like to add that a congressperson from Roswell High School would never act in this manner. We are just kind, loving people. Ignore the Jim Crow stuff back in the day. It was Georgia. What do you expect? Who anyway thinks about the poor? Because as any Milton kid will tell you, we are poor.
Wow.
I love this. I love the maintaining and attributing high school rivalry into adulthood,
yes,
and projecting it as the nucleus of all that. I truly enjoy this. Like, I'm over in Scotland right now, and it's funny because the towns have these like really old grudges where they'll be like, oh, people, no, you don't want to go to Hoik. Oh, no, they're terrible. They 800 years ago, they stole the head of our saint. Now, we're all atheists, but we're still angry about that head. Like, they'll get into this weird old European rivalry bullshit. And the only thing in America we truly have like that is high school rivalries. And so I commend you for truly embedding yourself in that Augustus, that August type of system.
I've held on to my high school rivalries. I went to Mater Dei, which is a big football school in California, and there's one from the Bay Area called Concord De La Salle, and they were our rivalry on like a bigger stage. And even though our football team was fantastic, De La Salle would always whoop our asses. And then flash forward like 15 years and I end up living a mile away from Concord De La Salle. And every single time I drove by, I went like, yeah, I had no cause to do that. The kids were kind. Like, I was amongst them in my neighborhood. I still despise them all. It just sticks with you.
At my high school, the debate team was the really cool thing that was popular and got all the sex. And so I don't remember who our football rivals were. And I think we were in a different category.
You're from Oklahoma.
Yeah, but I would go to football games, but I just hang out with my friends in the band. I don't remember. Plus, I think we were like, we'd petitioned up to 3A, but I don't think it was the same thing with debate. So the teams we were playing in debate weren't the same teams we were playing. And then you ended up just being friends with the other debaters. So anyway, there's a lesson there.
Master debaters.
Damn. I was looking to talk a lot of shit about our rival high school, which is Plantation High School. And everybody can make fun of that until you realize that I went to South Plantation High School, which is the only way that that name can get worse. But I don't know. It's a bunch of NFL players, a lady from the X Factor, and Carl Hiaasen, which I can't make fun of Carl Hiaasen. He's one of like the greatest Florida authors of all time. So yeah, fuck me. Oh, well. Anyway, thank you, listener. And I will, again, much in the same way that I will read one Andrew Heaton sports question every episode, I will also read petty high school rivalries about national political figures. Every episode, I will, if you have a, this guy sucks because he's from my rival high school, then I will read those each and every week. Send them on in. We're not wrong pod @gmail.com. Of course, this podcast is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is Will Saddleberg. Heaton, what's up on the ORF?
I talked to Lawrence Lessig, who's probably one of the biggest names in campaign finance reform over the last 20 years.
I love him. Good get. He
changed my mind on something. I disagree with him on the policy stuff. Like, I think if it were up to Lawrence, he would. You know, have a lot of campaign contribution caps, which I disagree with for reasons I will probably talk about more on the show. But he came on to talk about the court side of it. and why super PACs are treated differently than political action committees, and his legal theory that they should not be. And he made a very convincing case. So that is on the Political Orphanage this week. As Jen points out, I got a big guest in legal communities, and you can learn about the differences between super PACs and PACs, which will be relevant to the upcoming upcoming election. And you can hear me have my mind turned mid-sentence by a guy that has 20 years of experience turning people's minds.
Jen, what's going on in Congressional Dish?
So the last episode was a fun one. I watched all three UFO hearings and made a mashup of all the testimony, had a ball producing that. But that said, I do recommend, if you haven't heard it yet, going back into my archive, I believe it was around January of this year, I did do a similar mashup of all 20 hours of the January 6th committee investigations. If you really want to understand what this indictment is all about, I think that episode will really help you do it, especially if you don't like to read. So check
that
out.
I'm way, way fucking more interested in aliens than I am in the January 6th theories. I've inclined to check that out. Do you think the government has aliens?
So that was the thing. I went into it being like, this is going to be a quack fest. And like Joe watched it with me. Like we were popcorn popped, like just having a lot of fun with it. And then I realized how credible the witnesses were. So there's a lot of hearsay. So we need a lot of these people that have seen it themselves allegedly, but I'm leaning closer to yes than I ever have in my life. And I was not expecting that at all.
It's a guy who says that he talked to other guys who have seen things.
I know, but the way that he was in the position to say that is he was on this UAP task force for 4 years, pretty much for the whole time it existed. So, and he had top secret clearance. It was like, he was in the position to get that information, which I don't think I understood. So yes, it's all hearsay. But he says that he has witnesses willing to talk to Congress and he was going to give them those lists. So I feel like this was the beginning of an investigation. We have a long way to go. But the way that he was responding to Congress's questions, they would be like, do you have anyone that's willing to talk to us? He'd be like, yep, I'll give you their names right after the hearing. So I think we might sooner than later get testimony from people that have actually seen it themselves. So it was fun. It was real fun.
I'll start holding my breath.
I would fucking love it if it turned out there were aliens and we had some. That's a world, yeah. I want to live in. I remain unconvinced, sadly, by Occam's laser, but I will listen to your show, Jen, because I would love for the needle to move for me to a world in which aliens exist. I also think it's fun and that like the members of Congress that are super into alien disclosure are just, it has no connection from what I can tell to the regular slap fights. So like the most ardent guy is Tom something or other from
Burchett?
I want to say
Tennessee.
Yeah. And like he's just super into this. And I'm like, great, I'm here for this. I'm totally
super
like
into
I want
it.
There to be a UFO caucus, a bipartisan UFO caucus. Great.
Yeah. And what I found really interesting about it is like obviously when a dude comes to Congress and says we have alien bodies, that's the headline. But that's actually not why he blew the whistle. It was all an accounting thing with the Pentagon. So I actually found that to be really fascinating too, because when we say, does the government have aliens? Probably not. The corporations might have aliens. So yeah, listen to the episode. It was fascinating. And I feel like that was really not covered by anyone. The whole accounting thing that he's actually blowing the whistle about. It's a fun episode. And it was only like, I think I did it in about an hour, hour and 15 minutes. So it won't even take that long, even though there was 6 hours of testimony. Cause I also took the Pentagon testimony and stuck it in there too. So you can hear what they've been saying along with the whistleblowers. It was fun. I love this episode so much.
Nice.
There we go. And on PX3, we are getting into debate month. I'm going back and watching old debates from everybody that's going to be on stage August 23rd on Fox News. Wednesday's episode is Nikki Haley. I watched one of her re-election debates from when she was governor of South Carolina. And the Chris Christie debate prep segment that I'm going to do on Friday includes an opening question that is nearly note for note the same question that was first asked Donald Trump by Megyn Kelly in 2015 about name calling, which gave me a lot of insight into why I believe Chris Christie believes
He is the antidote to Donald John Trump. You can listen to that on PX3. But that's about it for today. Until next time, this is Justin Robert Young for Jen Briney and Andrew Heaton. We're not wrong. And more hats to you.
More hats.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.